listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
My name is Nick Ramos. I'm the Mellon Postdoctoral Fellow of Race and Science and Medicine. I'm one of the folks that convening members to make this event possible. I'd like to just take a moment to thank the institutions and centers that have also made this program today possible. So I'd like to thank the Square Center, the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice, and where we're at right now, the John Nicholas Brown Center. The COGUT, the Department of Africana Studies, and the MML, because they've been just wonderful. Part of the reason why this event is taking place is I teach a African-American health activism course that goes from colonialism to AIDS, and my students do a podcast as their final assignment. So part of this... this effort here is really, some of my students are here, is to have a bunch of curriculum and programming to supplement what they're learning in the classroom in terms of content and what they'll be producing. And it's also been in conjunction with an initiative through the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice called Working Out Loud, which brings people interested in using podcast medium, the medium of podcast, to lift up voices that we don't traditionally hear on the radio. Okay, I do want to introduce the moderator and the godsend of my class. She takes care of all the podcasting curriculum. Laura Garbes, who is a graduate student in sociology at Brown, here at Brown, where she teaches, advocates for students of color in academia, and examines the intersection of race, organizations, and cultural production. Please welcome Laura Garbes.
Thanks. Okay, hi everybody. So thank you so much for being here, and thanks so much, Nick, for that introduction and your continued collaboration in this, for making it possible. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to moderate this panel. It's a result of semester-long collaboration with a lot of working parts, most of whom Nick mentioned previously, so just echoing that. It kind of takes a constellation of bureaucracies and really stellar staff to build a good lunch panel. So thank you to everybody. So this panel is coming out of two different training programs, Working Out Loud with the CSSJ, and Professor Ramos's Africana Studies course, African American Health Activism. And the entire semester of programming arose out of actually a number of different threads, which I'm going to set up, and then I'll introduce our amazing panelists. So there's been sort of this increased interest in the potential for podcasting to be an accessible medium, right? So both in terms of production and consumption. And so there's this interest in universities to use podcasting as a public medium because of its relatively low barrier to access, right? And while academic papers kind of stay within the realm of journals behind paywalls, in the policy world, podcasts are easier to access, and they necessitate more accessible writing and language for comprehension through listening. It's just a different mode of taking in this information. So for instance, our students in the African American Health Activism class, we ask them to cut down on jargon for their scripts, so even if they're talking about complex things like racial capitalism, it's in a way that's accessible, that we can actually talk about in our own communities outside of these walls, right? And in addition, the creation of podcasts on the part of students kind of relies on interviewing individuals connected to and often affected by the topic under investigation. So it kind of creates a more experiential mode of inquiry and learning, right? But there's a complexity here of assigning audio rather than written essays. So professors have to think about these logistical challenges of anything from copyright law for using pre-recorded audio stories, audio sources, and then also teaching the technologies of sound recording. And so also, which now we're narrowing in on this panel specifically, professors have to grapple alongside their students with the ethics of community member participation and the audio sharing that goes beyond the interview, right? So in building from the lens of the Africana Studies course and the CSSJ, Center for Study of Slavery and Justice, there were some special considerations as we thought through the programming. We started asking ourselves, what happens when you initiate a conversation around journalistic ethics with folks predisposed to think about the intersection of systems of oppression, right? And so how might this become a springboard for a new kind of journalistic ethics? And as we developed this socially conscious programming throughout the semester, larger conversations of journalism and ethics and this both sides-ism that have absolutely been testing my patience in the larger national conversation has kind of been in the background, right? So I think you'll see that these panelists are kind of uniquely qualified to discuss these ethics, and I'm really excited to engage them. So we have first to my left, Jenny Stover. Dr. Jenny Stover is the inspiration for the title of the panel, as she coined the term sonic color line in her book by the same name, The Sonic Color Line, Race and the Cultural Politics of Listening. Can everybody hear me okay in the back? I just want to make sure. Okay, you're good. Okay, the book extends the Du Boisian insight of the color line to theorize its sonic elements. Jennifer Stover is also the editor-in-chief of the very popular Sounding Out blog. She received her PhD in American Studies and Ethnicity from USC and is currently associate professor at SUNY Binghamton, where she teaches courses on African-American literature and race and gender representation in popular music. Okay, so then next up to her left is Babette Thomas, a black radio producer originally from Oakland, California. She's also one of the current managing editors of Now Hear This, which is an undergraduate podcasting collective group organization on campus? All of it. Okay, I'll have her talk a little bit more about that as well. Her work is largely concerned with using sound and narrative to bring black history in conversation with the present. As co-creator with Johanna Obenda of Working Out Loud, she has been integral in thinking through how to develop programming that considers the ethical and technical dimensions of audio production simultaneously. And finally, last but not least, we have Alex Hainsworth, who grew up listening to audiobooks in a nook somewhere on Fidalgo Island, Washington. She now spends her days studying, teaching, and making radio for Now Hear This and the RISD Museum. And she mostly makes stories about art, history, intimacies, and the intersections of the three. And as a mentor for Working Out Loud, she guided first-time audio creators through the process, including through its ethical considerations. So first, let's just give it up for our panelists before we begin, and then I'll like end the very long intro. And I just want to start out by asking the three of you why and how you became interested not only in creating audio, but also teaching audio production. So either in your courses or in your roles as Now Hear This editors, right?
Okay, well, I publish podcasts. I don't produce them myself, but through Sounding Out as a venue, which was started, it'll be 10 years ago, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this summer, with myself and two former graduate students now, one's a professor at UC Irvine, Erin Chamel, who's our multimedia editor, and Liana Silva, who's our managing editor. She's a PhD public school teacher in Houston. And we started working together to share our ideas and keep our ideas going around sound studies. It was also a way for us to foster community both inside the academy and also outside. All three of us are first-generation PhDs, and we wanted our families to have a way to understand what we were doing and why it was important. So every post is edited and podcast is edited in mind with a family member or thinking of, like, well, you know, why are we always working? Why can't we attend these things? Why do we have to live across the country? Like, all those questions that come up when you come from a family that is not ensconced in academia. So that was part of our, like, how we think about accessibility, and our audience has grown to include audio professionals, people that are just interested in sound, radio folks, scholars, and we wanted to start a podcast as part of, like, going all the way in terms of, like, not just writing about audio and including sound, but also honoring, like, that audio is a way of thinking, and audio is a way of arguing, that audio can be argument, not just content, but also editing as argument, sound as argument, and being really attentive to those things. Erin is our editor, and I have to give a shout out before we even go any further, just the way that he has edited it is not just scouting out work, but very hands-on, and we are really committed to accessibility, not just in presentation, but we want to help foster first-time podcasters. So Aaron works with anyone from people who send him a draft ready to go, and he listens and gives them feedback, to, I think this would be a good idea for a podcast. I've never made one before. And he'll sit and have sessions with them, like helping them do storyboarding and ideas. And sometimes they send him clips and he puts it together. And so we really, the same way that we develop writing, we also develop podcasts for our series that way. So it became also a way of not just, I think sometimes people think of podcasting as, well, I'm going to present the scholarship I've already done in a different format, whereas we're much more about, like, how do we create knowledge together through this medium? And also for us, it became a way to hack the academy as well for a field that was very new, for a field that not only voices that aren't usually heard on the radio, but scholarly voices that are not often heard in, you know, in publishing. And so it's like this field is moving so fast that by the time these anthologies come out that are canonizing so many of the graduate students of color, white women graduate students, doing that kind of innovative work at the ground level, grassroots of the field, suddenly vanish and they're not cited. And so Sounding Out became a way to archive that kind of work, that kind of labor, in a way that is easily searchable on the internet and shows up, and that people are like, you have to cite this. It's here. You've seen it. We know. So the podcast, we've been going for 11 years. We're on our 75th one. And we publish anything from sound walks to interviews to art pieces. And we're really trying to push the medium that way. So that's kind of my role in terms of publishing and helping students in the classroom then use it as a medium to think and to connect and to produce knowledge together.
So I was thinking about earlier today, like, where exactly, like, my audio storytelling practice, like, came from, like, where it started. And yeah, now that I think about it, my audio storytelling practice definitely came out of a place of, like, angst and, like, rage. I found that when I first came to Brown, I was just, like, really mad about a lot of things, like, really frustrated. And so my first week at Brown, I heard about this group called Now Hear This, which is the group that me and Alex are now managing editors of. And I decided, I was like, you know what, like, I want to pitch a story. Like, I'm really frustrated. I feel like the parties at Brown are very much segregated by race. Like, that was a topic that, like, I was just, like, frustrated by. It's something that was impacting my experience. So I decided to make an audio story about the, like, nature of the party scene at Brown. And this involved me, like, taking a recorder to, like, all these different kinds of parties, like, frat parties, just, like, different kinds of, like, parties, and just kind of, like, sonically comparing my experiences at these various types of parties. And then I interviewed, it's like a running joke and Now Hear This, because, like, this is my first story ever, and I interviewed, like, 20 people. Like, I just went around and interviewed, like, seniors. Like, I was just so excited. Like, what do you think about the party scene? What do you think about the party scene? Like, how do you wish it could change? How has it changed over your time at Brown? So that was the first story that I ever made through Now Hear This. And yeah, I kind of got hooked after that. I was really excited by how accessible it was to me as a producer, in terms of I could just use my phone, or I could just use, like, GarageBand to go back and edit. But I was also, like, people were actually, like, listening to this story is what I was, like, really struck by. And I was also, like, just really, really interested in, like, the intimacy of sound, the fact that people kind of tend to freeze up a little bit more when you turn, like, a camera towards them. But when, like, it's just audio, I feel like people are, like, much more open and much more willing to talk about things that are maybe hard to talk about. So that was kind of, like, my first experience producing a story. And then kind of, like, my next story is also coming from a place of rage, where I interviewed 4 African-American students talking about their experiences of what it means to be, like, the descendants of enslaved people and living amongst the legacies of slavery at Brown. So that was kind of my first story that dealt with history, the history of Brown's involvement with the transatlantic slave trade. And that's kind of when I started thinking about, like, radio as, like, yes, a very accessible medium, a very, like, intimate medium, but also a medium that can kind of exist as, like, a counter site, and thinking about ideas of building, like, a counter archive to, like, narratives. Like, I was doing a lot of archival research for this story about, you know, what street signs are named after people who owned enslaved people on, like, near Brown's campus. And what you find is that a lot of that information is like missing from the archive. So how can a sound work both uplift the voices of like the descendants of enslaved people, but also recontextualize that history and kind of creating this like counter school of knowledge is what I really started to get interested in that. So that's kind of where I veered less towards the getting frustrated about parties and more towards kind of like the history side of things. Not that the party thing is that valid. I still feel certain feelings about that. But that's kind of when I started thinking about, okay, like how can I speak to, for me, what is important, like a Black American history, and bring it to the present through my own narrative, through talking to my peers, and also like through sound design. So like another story that I recently made was like, okay, like you might know about like blues women like Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, like Gladys Bentley, but did you know that they, like, they were all gay and like would go to like these like gay parties and just have sex with each other? Or another one more recently that I did was Zora Neale Hurston's contributions to the WPA project of what is known as like the Alan Lomax recordings of the South, but talking about like her neglected history in that project. So that's kind of where my audio trajectory has gone recently in terms of like thinking about like Black history. And the teaching element kind of just comes in for me where I think everyone should be able to have that outlet. Like if you are feeling frustrated about something or like you do want to take maybe these like very academic ideas and boil them down in a more accessible way, ensuring that people like do have that outlet and have the means of production to do that. Because for me, I think the ultimate goal is like, okay, like This American Life, Ira Glass, great, okay, I've heard it before. Like how cool and exciting would radio be if you just like heard your friends on the radio talking about like what they cared about and like what interested them? And I think like that might be a utopia, but I'm like constantly gunning for it. And like that's what I ultimately want. So yeah.
I've been trying to, Babette and I have been talking about like how to answer this question for the past like 4 days. I fell really in love with audio, I think, when I was actually really young, listening to audiobooks in the car with my family, and feeling really transported by those sounds. And then sort of like a few years later, in like early high school, finding like podcasts in like the early days of podcasts. And I grew up in a really small town, and so like finding this like avenue for learning about the world like felt really exciting. And it felt like This American Life and like The Heart, and all of these different programs were like really making me like think about like the world around me in new ways that felt really exciting. And so I remember like my junior year of high school, I was like, I want to make radio. And I convinced my parents to get me like a little recorder. And then I like sat down with my best friend and made her like read me these like letters that a boy had sent her in her locker. Because I was like, this is the story that needs to be told. but then I really didn't know how to take those recordings and make anything out of them or like what that thing would be. And then when I was looking for colleges, this is really embarrassing, I found out that Ira Glass went to Brown, and I was like, I have to go to Brown. and then I found out about Now Hear This when I was looking through student organizations, and then I was really convinced. And then when I ended up here, I still wasn't sure if radio was the thing that I was going to do or not, but I sort of... I pitched a story about these recordings of these love letters that my friend had received to Now Hear This, and like miraculously it was accepted. and I think like coming to Brown, like I think that the way that I think is really like hands-on and really visual, and I sometimes have a really hard time with theory and with really dense language, and so I feel like having Now Hear This and making radio as like a method of exploration and a method of like trying to understand the world around me, like through making and through listening to people like talk to me as like another human, just like kept feeling really, really good. And so I kept following that wherever I could. which resulted in me designing my own concentration in radio. And then I think the teaching aspect came in because it had been such an important skill and like mode of like being for me. And I wanted to give that back to anyone who was also interested in that kind of thinking. Yeah.
That's really cool. So yeah, I'm hearing a lot about this idea of encountering this sound and saying there's this sense of like world opening, mm-hmm. this sense of a democratizing force. And then, you know, when you turn from just consuming it to actually like going about thinking through like how you're gonna make the story, you think about starting to, and we talked about this earlier today in class, like kind of what it means to think in sound and how that feels different, mm-hmm. right? And so I guess I wanted to just ask, how do you sort of transmit, or like how is teaching that experience a bit different from kind of, for example, teaching writing composition or something like that? And then the other hand, right, Babette, you were mentioning sort of your trajectory as a producer, right? The sense of responsibility in creating this contextualization and creating these deep histories and also these underrepresented histories, right? And also expressing angst that there aren't outlets for in particular institutional spaces, right? Mm-hmm. So like, how do you, when you're thinking through your lesson plan for folks either in your classroom or during your orientations to now hear this, how do you kind of foreground radio's potential, but also an audio producer's responsibility? And I can clarify if that makes
sense. In a classroom setting, I think for me, teaching people to focus on listening and really actually think about how they listen. I actually teach a course called How They Listen is really important, because I think part of what my book is about, The Sonic Color Line, is that audio in Western culture and philosophy has been for many years taken for granted, that we have this complex language to talk about visuality and the gaze and how we kind of, you know, we see and align sight with reason so often that, mm-hmm. that the other senses just happen, quote, naturally. And so what I do in my book is kind of break down and say, no, that our senses, I focus particularly on sound, but that all of our senses are in fact disciplined by culture, by ideology. And I specifically focus on race, but I really do look at the intersection of how do we come to learn this way of being that is white, middle class, masculine as the norm, as what, and it's taught to us as a kind of unspoken etiquette about what is appropriate, right? What is, and eventually, I mean, in the book I talk about what is American and how American gets associated, tones of voice, etc., with a, you know, without saying it, right? And that we kind of naturalize how voices sound, how spaces are supposed to sound, music and certain genres. So one of the things I do with students is to try to denaturalize listening. So I do a couple of things. I have them do sound walks, which is a mode of, you know, actually doing a walk through space, a particular space, and only listening, as if it's a very easy task, right? So I do a sample one with them, and then we talk about what did you hear, what did you not hear. And as a class, then they're like, oh, wait a minute, like half the class heard the chemistry building roaring and half the class didn't. And I'm like, oh, the chemistry students didn't hear it because they're in there all the time and they don't like, and so we talk about how do you develop those habits? How do you learn to attune to things? Then I have them design their own sound walk of Binghamton, the city in which I teach. And I say, you know, hey, capture the essence of this town. So in a way, it's kind of like they're producing a live radio or podcast experience of like, I want someone to walk through space. Here's an affect, how I feel about the town. I want to transmit this to them. So they spend a lot of time designing this. They write an analysis of it. And at this point, they're still pretty much thinking that I'm crazy, and then everyone hears things the same way. And, you know, But what I do is I take their maps that they draw and I anonymize them and I trade them with a partner. So then they receive a sound walk that they don't know who designed it, and they have each other. So they actually get to meet at the end of the semester. I do run a lot of my classes like a reality show. There's a big reveal at the end of the semester. But they find out a lot of things. So then they have to do the opposite kind of thought process where they're going on this walk and thinking, how is this, you know, how do I feel? How is this supposed to make me feel? I'm confronted with my own feelings about it. I'm hearing it a certain way. And then they start catching themselves, imagining who the person was that designed this, where they're from, what they look like, what gender they are. And they realize that they're carrying around all of these assumptions about listening and about listening's attachment to all of these, you know, social positions. So when they finally meet in class, they get to sit and talk about, you know, did they have radically different experiences? Why is it? Is it because you grew up in the Bronx and you grew up in Long Island? Is it? And they spend a good amount of time going through that. And that's the moment in class when that idea that listening isn't a universal really begins to click. Some students, of course, knew it all along and could be teaching it, but other students, it's a really powerful moment. Like, I remember one time in class, a student was talking about how on their sound walk that they were doing that another student, we all talk about space, and like, I designed it in the space because I feel so comfortable in Binghamton, and it's like a predominantly white neighborhood on the side of downtown. And we talk about, well, wait a minute, like comfort and sound, and so we begin to talk about racial elements of how neighborhoods are supposed to sound and who feels comfortable. And a student was asked, a Latinx student was asked to walk around downtown, and it happened during that time of day to be when the hockey game was letting out in downtown Binghamton. And he had been wearing a hoodie, and he was telling the class, like, yeah, everyone started crossing the street. And he's like, I felt really, you know, I felt really unsafe. And we were talking about them, like, how many other people felt unsafe for, you know, either, you know, even if for a second on your sound walk. And the majority, all white women, all the men and women of color raise their hands, and there's like 10 white men in the class kind of like looking around. And it was a really powerful moment for everyone in the classroom. So doing things like that to actually get people to think about listening before doing, you know, going to the audio and like that you are thinking in sound and tracking it even if you're not conscious of it. So making it more of a making it conscious and weird so that when you go sit down to do podcasting and things, you're starting to recognize, like, oh, when I'm putting voices together, I'm making an argument. I'm juxtaposing how these voices sound for a reason. So,
yeah. I think for me and, like, my work and, like, Now Hear This, but also working out loud, this has kind of been, like, largely a process of, like, moving away from like the story and more towards the individual. So for me, kind of what that looks like is some of the most like popular podcasts I feel like in the past like 10 years are just like these really insane like stories. Like there's kind of a shock factor. Like Serial, insane story. Like S-Town, crazy story. Like just really wild stories that are only possible because This American Life has a lot of money and they can send out like reporters to this town to like spend this time like working on these stories. And like they're amazing stories, like that's why they become popular. But kind of this idea, I think when a lot of people like approach audio storytelling, they're like, oh, I kind of want to make like the next like This American Life. Like I'm really inspired by that. And like that's like a totally valid feat, but I think in my work and like Now Hear This and the workshop, it's been the idea that you can kind of move more towards your own community and like your own story matters. Like you don't need to go out to these communities that aren't your own and interview people that you don't really have a prior relationship with to have these really amazing stories. And I think kind of when we focus on the story kind of in journalism, it almost becomes extractive where you're kind of prioritizing the story over people in a way. Like you're ultimately just trying to get the story. Like that's kind of your goal. Like I feel like in a lot of like radio handbooks that we've read, it's like, you know, get the scoop at whatever cost it takes. And it's like, how is that neglecting like personhood? How is that neglecting like people and individuals? Kind of just moving towards like the importance of like individual narratives and like moving towards this idea that like, maybe your friend like talks about like scuba diving in a really beautiful way, or maybe like your friend like has like notes like put in their locker. Like there are these really like small like beautiful stories like all around us in our communities that I feel like are just like waiting to be told. And so, like, kind of in teaching, we, like, I think, like, tell folks, like, hey, like, you can look inward, like, for your stories. You can look towards yourself. Like, you don't have to, like, be looking, like, always necessarily be looking outward. And I think that kind of also ties into the writing as well, whereas, like, the writing can be, like, also, like, for radio, it can be, like, I'm really an advocate for, like, radio as working through whatever you have going on, like, in your mind that you need to kind of get off your chest. So I think that kind of ties in where it's, like, writing for radio can almost be, like, essay-like, but in a way where you're still kind of trying to make it accessible. So kind of, like, how can you boil down, like, these ideas, not how you would an academic essay, but, like, for someone who's maybe, like, never heard about this, like, topic before. And, yeah, do you have any...
Yeah.
Some thoughts on that.
Yeah, like Babette was saying, I feel like when I was first learning radio, I was looking a lot at like transom.com for people who've heard of that, which is like a common radio like teaching resource, which is it's a great resource. But I remember reading a lot of tips like, oh, if like the person you're interviewing's fridge is really loud, ask them to like unplug it, which is crazy to me that you would go into someone's space and like... like take control of it in that way without like, and so like I think in the way that I think personally like about radio has shifted a lot since then into thinking about like recordings as like really complex interactions between people, and so when I'm teaching people radio, which is sort of a thing that I've been doing for the past year. Like I try to foreground that it's like an interaction, and like that the way that you like treat the person that you're interviewing is really important. Like how you explain like how close you have to hold the mic to their face is a really important part of it. And yeah, I think I try to talk about like I feel like when I was taught like the tools of radio, I was just like, here's a recorder, here's the buttons you press, like this is what it does. So when I teach people how to use recorders, I try to talk about like the history of like recording devices, like how we came to have this thing, what kind of like historical moment it came out of. They were largely sort of invented, you know, a long history of invention, but the person who's usually named is Thomas Edison, sorry. Very different man. who made this like phonograph thing with a needle on the end that would scratch a sound wave into a tin can, and then you would put the needle back in the line that was scratched and it would recreate the sound and this... but just like what it means to be like when you make a recording, I think people talk about this a lot. Sorry, I'm rambling. With photography, but less with sound recording. Like when you make a recording, you're making it from a particular perspective, and you're like looking at things in a particular way. And just because like we think of sound recording as like a more sort of objective, total process, doesn't mean that it is. Which I think is like more apparent, like when you're recording with like binaural mics. I don't know if people know. They're like little tiny mics that you put in either ear that record sound as it's coming into your ear. So if someone were to listen to that recording, they would get a sense of the space in the same way that you do through your ears. But that recording is like marked by your physical body and like the way that that becomes a null point in the recording. And so I think like talking about that kind of thing foregrounds like your position as like a human encountering the world, and that like recording and making radio is like a process of like taking these traces of like your movement through the world and then like crafting them into a thing that you're sharing with other people, and that it's a really complex process. So
really great. Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of really good different insights and a lot of through threads. So you know, in thinking back to this idea of if there were a different journalistic ethic foregrounded with your insights, so far I'm like thinking about the aspect of humility. So like this idea that you have to have respect for the idea that you, the way you hear things is not the way that everybody else
yes.
hears things through, you know, so when you were talking about the sound walk, Jenny, all the way to when Alex was just talking about, like, the lens of the photography, what is the way to say, like, the hearing ear, the listening ear? It's, like, contingent on, you know, kind of your space in the world, so thinking
yes.
about positionality, right?
Yes.
And then there's also the respect factor. It's like the respect for anyone involved in the process, whether it be, you know, thinking about, oh, maybe I should think through who I'm talking to
mm-hmm.
and whether I have an intimate relationship with them before I go ahead and really intrusively enter into their really intense experience, or Babette, as you're saying, maybe start out looking internally and instead building relationships with folks, not in a transactional way, but sort of in an interactional way. That's what I was hearing across these three things, which is great. I have so many questions about that, but
yeah.
Okay, so maybe I'll link it back to a few folks sent in questions earlier on, you know, in advance of this. So there was a question about whether you've relied on resources for this type of work, like pedagogically, and I'll also add on to that, like, if there was, like, one thing you think there were, you wish there were more talk about in, say, for example, Trans On, just for an example, which is a great resource, but, you know, also kind of lacks that sort of foregrounding of humility, respect, and positionality, right? Is there anything else you kind of wish were out there? And also, you know, what is out there, hopefully, for folks just getting started that want to do a kind of self-reflexive practice as they're learning how to do the audio techniques?
Sorry, can you say the question one more time?
Yeah, totally. So first of all, resource guides. Have there been any that you've leaned on, or any particular resources accessible online, accessible publicly, that folks can kind of, like, go to after this, that would be helpful to them? And if not, right,
mm-hmm.
What are some things you think folks should sort of foreground in their practice of either teaching or getting started on this?
I'm gonna look up one on Twitter. I'm not texting, I promise. I think in Twitter, as well as Sounding Out has a Twitter, and I know that we posted a really excellent, like, entry-level teaching podcast resource. That I believe came from Anja Kongeiser, who is a sound artist in Australia that works on climate equity and does radio around that. So I'm gonna look that up in a second.
Yeah. And another thing is we can follow up with folks in the
yeah.
audience and actually have a list.
It'll be like
show notes. but, yeah.
For some of the kind of audio pre-stuff, there is a great resource that was put out by MIT Collab last year that is called Listening in the City. And it was a meeting for scholars, activists, and artists that do work, kind of civically engaged, site-based work in cities. And there are really easy kind of listening, easy in the sense of reproducible, difficult practice in the classroom, but kind of places to start if you want to do work with audio exercise and audio storytelling, that, like, kind of here's how to begin doing that in your classroom. And they have best practices, they have samples. There's a little bit about the Binghamton Historical Soundwalk Project, something that I was working on in there, and their artists from all over the country. And that took place, where did we meet? Well, in Boston, yeah, it's in Boston. And they went to the podcast workshop, the podcast garage there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of stuff from, I think, the out of the blocks people, they're in that. And so that I know that that's PDF and that's freely available, and there's a lot of good stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
I was just gonna add, like, that was a great question, a conversation about, like, technology and how technology changes the we think of it as transparent. And I think the other thing is practicing with students. When they do those sound walks, I ask them to record it. But, like, I kind of constantly repeat, like, a microphone is not an ear, right? That we kind of think, and maybe because it's so small now and unobtrusive, you think of it as an extension of your listening. And then when they go back, they realize that they've recorded a very different experience than what they've written down. And that also, and sometimes it picks up more things that you miss and you have to go, well, why did I miss that? And other times you're like, oh, it was in my pocket and it only has my jacket. Where, you know, that kind of thing where they learn a lot about it, but also, and what you can do with voices, right? That you said, like, when you put and record someone close, you can kind of create that feeling of intimacy. When you pull it away, you can kind of create a sense of distance, whereas the microphone's picking it up, but you're making an effective statement on that voice and how you end up using that voice, that it isn't, it's not objective, and it's also not an ear. So we gotta figure out what it is and how we're gonna use it, how we're gonna use it ethically. And the point about extraction, I was gonna add, like, there's the flip side of that is in production, it's like, you extract and you get the story at any cost, and then there's an awful lot of ventriloquism, right? Then use these voices to do certain things, to either speak for you or to become. We were talking earlier that, you know, using things like accents, et cetera, as sound effects, or that kind of ethics in editing and use and how you put together and how you, how you surface voices in your work is really important to think about.
Yeah, I think, so there are a lot of organizations that host workshops that I think kind of get this, like, these critical questions of audio storytelling. Like, Allied Media Conference is one that I'm thinking about. Like, Union Docs in New York is another one I'm thinking about. Most of their workshops and, like, those types of things, like, you do have to pay for, though. So, like, they're not free, which is always a bummer. But I think for me, when I was first starting out audio storytelling, I think one of, like, my biggest struggles was, like, finding the kind of stories that I wanted to make and, like, not necessarily really hearing them. Mm-hmm. And, like, not really hearing people, like, critically grappling with, like, these kind of questions that we're thinking about, like, in the way that I was hoping for. I think a really good resource for that, for, like, inspiration is Third Coast. They're an audio festival in Chicago that takes place every year, but they also have a website where they, like, amplify or, like, just, like, a platform for, like, new producers to show their work, like, depending on if they're, like, selected. They have playlists, like, based around, like, certain themes, and it's just, like, a really good, like, collection of stories, and we, like, know one of the people who, like, kind of, like, works there, and, like, I think they're just really critically thinking about sound in a way that's really exciting. They don't really have any resources for, like, how to get started with audio storytelling, but if you're just looking for inspiration, which I think is a really big part of it, Third Coast is a great resource.
And wait, before you continue, I want y'all to self-promote, because also you guys have resources, so.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, also, so I don't know if you want
to piggyback off of both of
us. No, you're good. I'm thinking, like, you guys have a really good.
Yeah.
Is it an audio zine or is it a printed zine?
It's a printed zine. Yeah. Or more of a digital zine. There's, like, a couple printed.
Yeah. First, before I forget, Third Coast also, like, within their podcast, which is called Resound, they reproduce every workshop that happens at their festival, which isn't necessarily, like, set at a beginner level because it's for, like professional audio makers, but is really, really useful and has, like, a lot of, like, information about sound design and, like, story structure and, like, all kinds of things.
Audience, like, just lots of
And so they make all of those freely available on their website. But yes, last semester, me and one of our managing editors who graduated, Mitchell Johnson, wrote a producer manual zine guidebook for how to make radio. It's about 50 pages. We're still figuring out how to get it up on our website, but we can email it out to everybody who came to this. And it will eventually be up on our website. But other resources, there's a book called Out on the Wire that's a really easy to read comic book. This comic journalist, Jessica Abel, went to, like, I think five different radio shows and just sort of walked through their process, how they make radio. And that was a really important resource for me early on. There's also a podcast, I think it's just called Tape Podcast, but it's just interviews with different radio makers about their practice and what they're thinking about when they're making radio. And I think there's some gems in there. And Transom, we've already talked about. They have a podcast called How Sound that is not perfect, but has a lot of useful things in it. Yeah, was there another part of the question?
No, I think actually what I'll do then is, I have a lot more questions, but I'm going to open it up to the audience now and see whether they have any questions, if that's cool.
I want to say, I just sent you and Nick the link to that podcast guide.
So oh, cool. Yeah.
On to ConGuys are put together. It's on archive.org. It's free.
You guys will have a follow-up email with a lot of resources coming your way. So.
Yes, and I'm glad for our 51st. We meant to do it for our 50th, but it actually snuck by, so we did it for our 51st podcast. But it's kind of a manifesto about sound and why sounding out in particular. We got a really nasty kind of like comment about how our kind of like that. I think for me, that was the point when like the early years of podcasting shifted over, is like that Ira Glass Radio Lab. All of a sudden, it had to sound as if it had all this force of neoliberal money behind it,
right.
And like the, like how can we get our audiences to listen or honor the audiences that do listen more widely that don't expect that, but there's kind of this idea that our audiences are like capitalist consumers, and if it doesn't sound gorgeous, then it's not worth putting out. And so we took that criticism as an opportunity to speak back to kind of the audiophilic tendency, that if it doesn't sound like this, then it's not good radio, and kind of what are the classed, race, gendered implications of that, mm-hmm. and why some of ours sound that way, some of ours don't, and for us it's kind of, access is also about exactly that, like I want to hear my friends' voices on the radio, why aren't they there, and kind of breaking that down too, that it doesn't need to always sound perfect, and that we like to err on the side of as many kind of different points of view as possible, rather than narrowing it down to it all has to sound the same in this, mm-hmm. this gorgeous kind of, as if that's the only way to think of what gorgeous sound sounds like. So that manifest is online, and I'll send you
yes.
guys the link too.
You'll have links on your follow-up email. Do you folks have any questions? Okay. Maybe we'll go counterclockwise, so we'll start out.
Yeah, so my question, first of all, thank you for being here, it's awesome. As like a woman who works in radio, a woman of color in radio, it's like so great to see you all there, it's great. So my question is about tone and writing for radio, and it's like you're balancing all these things, especially when you deep dive into like historical traumas and like,
yes.
and then people who are still alive dealing with them, and things like race and gender and identity. How do you deal with this tone that could go super academic or not, and then like trying to get it to like a mainstream audience that's not dumbing down the complexity or the nuance, but is also like relaying the story, and then also representing yourself too. Like, do you find that you've changed your voices or like, you know, tried to fit into what mainstream listeners are listening
yeah.
to, both as women and, you know, if like, and then race is part of that too.
I think part of that for me is like going back to the idea of who is the mainstream listener and what are the assumptions that we make about who that mainstream listener is, who they have been historically, who they actually are now, and kind of also part of how the sonic color line works is that it creates these kind of disciplinary voices in all of our heads, that in order to sound credible, I have to sound like this. We're calling it, from Troy McClure
to Ira Glass,
was
right?
Our, like, you know, that the idea that a certain tone, you know, Troy McClure on The Simpsons, that one of the jokes behind it was, is if you said it in this certain tone, this certain masculine, middle-class, Cold War serious tone, you could say anything ridiculous, and it sounds as if it's, right, the most amazing documentary ever. So, you know, in a way, it's like, that's all tone argument without actually saying anything.
Yeah.
And then, right, you have these... So we're kind of like, how can we challenge through our audio production who the mainstream listener is and what they want? And maybe that mainstream listener becomes, you know, marginalized in certain ways. And, you know, so breaking open that idea of what the mainstream and who the mainstream listener is.
I think that question gets to a good point, too, about, like, the explanatory comma as well, and, like, when we decide to explain things and stories based on who we assume the mainstream listener is. I don't have much to say, just adding that to the conversation.
Do you have any immediate thoughts on, like, story?
Something that I think about a lot, especially with my work in the RISD Museum, is, like, what kind of relationship am I setting up, not only between me and the people whose voices I'm including, but between me and the person who's eventually going to listen to it, like, what kind of interaction is happening there? And I know that, like, big academic words are really useful for people in those fields, but I also, like, believe really strongly that, like, you don't need them to get important ideas across, and that, like, accessibility is not the same as dumbing down language, and that, like, it's just a matter of, like, having a, like, more personal, intimate interaction with someone. Like, you can explain almost anything to a friend. And so I think, like, extending that care to, like, the listener is, like, usually the way that I think about how to, like, balance academic, like, jargon and, like, more personal language. That was what I was thinking about.
Yeah, we tend to, like, think of jargon as, like, jargon means an in-group language, right? And so thinking about it as, like, jargon is as exclusionary as it can be inclusionary, but also at the same time, sometimes, like, something like intersectionality, that term can be dismissed as jargon, but we know that that, and it is often very misunderstood, but that, that accesses this very important specific thing that is a tool. So how can we look at, say, a term like intersectionality as a tool toward deeper understanding, which is very rigorous, rather than a term that's just kind of used to exclude, like, someone who accesses their feminism and activism outside of the academy. So it's like using it as a way, like, for sounding out our posts, our rule is, like, one, if you're going to use, like, an academic term, it has to be toward a deeper understanding, basically, like, one or two per piece, and have the explanatory comma, that they should be there to actually open up understanding rather than be focused inward toward an in-group conversation. But it keeps it, like, yeah, like you said, it provides a way to actually create a conversation. Oh God, I had something to add to this. It'll come back to me.
And I think you also had a question.
I was more I was more curious about the second part of your earlier question about resources and what is that missing resource? What is the thing that you wish you had as a resource, especially looking now at showing other people this? You know, what is that? What is the thing that you just absolutely wish that there was a resource on?
Oh, so this is like the magic wand question.
It is the magic wand question.
Okay.
And I suppose connected to showing others and getting others into this.
A magic resource, if I could think back, would be audio editing training from elementary school for people of color and women in particular. Like, I find in the academy that this tends to be an expertise that's often picked up outside of the educational setting by men, passed on to men. And I think that is one of the biggest barriers to all of this, is that by the time you get to in college to learn it, you don't have the time you had once had. Girls in general don't often have that time, because, you know, if you got time to lean, you got time to clean was what was going on in my house. And so, like, those gender things are real, and those are all our barriers to picking up this kind of knowledge. And it's much, I've co-taught a course twice with a colleague who does audio production, and I've been hoping to pick it up along with the students finally. But it's like, I still, even now, like, I don't have it, like, so I'm like, God, if I only I had these kinds of things. And there's a group called Women's Audio Mission in San Francisco, a nonprofit, that's part of what they do. And they do some free online courses. They are working, you know, to get some of these trainings much earlier. Like, we're talking about, there's writing labs, but we don't have audio labs on campus where you can go and learn these things in ways that are free, in ways that are accessible, that aren't something that you pick up kind of extra, that you are left out of that conversation.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm really interested in the history of radio because I think that's how, like, it shapes kind of how we think about radio
yes.
and, like, podcasting in the present. So just, like, a magic wand, like, resource that I'm, like, actually trying to work on this summer is, like, kind of, like, an online chronology of, like, the, like, radical history of radio, I think would be so compelling and, like, interesting. Just this idea that, like, you know, like, during the Civil Rights Movement, like, Black community-owned radio was just, like, such a force and, like, such an essential part of, like, the Civil Rights Movement. And, like, in many countries, like, during times of, like, revolution, like, radio has played, like, a really key and essential role. And I think, like, contextualizing that and kind of, like, the current political moment also, like, how are we thinking about these tools, I think would be, like, really, like, promise. That's just, like, such a dream for me. I would just love, like, to, like, take the time to, like, make something like that. Because I think it would impact how we are thinking about, like, podcasting in the present also.
Yeah, I would second both of those. I feel like in terms of teaching, like, a resource that talks about audio production in an accessible way and also historicizes the tools that we're using and puts them in, like, the context that, like has an attention to, like, the ways that power are impacting even, like, the technological considerations. And then I think the other thing that would be useful in terms of a, like, teaching is, like, I feel like like, I've had to learn a lot through bits and pieces, like, what different narrative structures, like, what kind of work they're doing in the world, like how to recognize when a story is, like, sensationalism, and, like, the kinds of, like, easy pitfalls when you're just looking for, like, a good story. And so I think, like, a resource... yeah, to help people, like, think more deeply about, like, what work their stories are doing out in the world. And then, yeah, I think, like the history of radio. And, like I think that the podcasting world has kind of detached itself from that history in a big way. It, like, thinks of itself as, like, its own, like, all-encompassing thing. And thinking about its roots, I think, is really important.
I'm just gonna add on that, like, oh my god, these notes, like, in response, like, the email I'm gonna send to y'all after this MBA is so long. but I'm even thinking about bouncing off what you were saying, and I want to share this with you. It's like the there's this podcast I just listened to on the history of guerrilla radio in Roxbury, which I like. It's like basically the amount of police raids on this community radio station because they were operating at a lower wattage because they couldn't get licensing from the state. But they were just trying to provide community resources. So that bringing that history into the space, I think, is totally right. And I think also, like, keeping that in mind as you're trying to talk about, like, the more technical part of audio education. I will also say, I'll add, like, an article on, it's like a linguistic anthropology, like, study on the audiophile jargon and as an exclusionary tool. And I think that's, like, really important in terms of, like, breaking down barriers is just making sure that spaces are not, like, presumed to be for one type of person, that it's like, if you know, you know, right? You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, I think the Writing Center is like, it's sort of embedded in, like at Brown is like sort of embedded in different class settings and stuff like that. And it's located at like UFLY as well. So it's like, how can we make sure that audio education kind of has a similar space from, like, growing up writing, growing up also thinking in sound, because I think that would be an awesome magic wand to be, like a through line throughout.
I do just want to shout out Leo and the MMLs for offering that service at Brown, and Claire, who was here earlier, who runs a lot of those workshops.
Yeah, and all the CTAs that you trained is, like, really incredible. And has been instrumental in making our podcast assignment possible for the course. Yeah. Okay, I also want to be mindful that a lot of folks have 1 p.m. engagements in classes. However, we have the space until 1:15. So just so you know, it's like not off awkward. It's not awkward if you guys like get up and leave, is what I'm saying. Because I know y'all got places to be. But we want to open it up to other questions as well, as long as we have the space.
I'm just curious, so like implementing this in like a classroom setting and teaching students how to create stories and things like that seems like, I mean, great. And it's exciting that they would want to listen to each other's stories versus writing a paper. Like, students never want to read each other's papers at the end of the semester. But I also worry about, A, like where I would host those for students to listen to each other's, and the ethics of making something public. Both the ethics of kind of the consent of the people recorded, but also students like testing out ideas that they don't want to like last forever. You know, I mean, I'm not publishing their papers or something online forever. And so I'm curious if y'all have thoughts about that dynamic, the kind of ethics of like publicizing student work and yeah, just kind of other ethical considerations that are connected to that.
For me, like using best practice for oral history in terms of like actually signing, like getting releases done, talking with students about what the releases, how they work, and making sure that they're talking to their co-creators and the people that they're in conversation with about, you know, what the end product will be, whether or not they will be published online. People should know that ahead of time, whether or not they will be edited, whether they're going to be live, because it really does. I've done interviews to like live or like, you know, no edits, and I've done interviews where I'm allowed to say, oh, let me start over, you know, like, and that makes a difference in the kind of things you can say. And so really having that clear from the beginning. And the Oral History Association has some really good templates from UCLA, from other places. The Voces Oral History Workshop at the University of Texas Austin is amazing. If you do have financial resources, I can go and get trained there from Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, who's a journalist and a scholar, and Todd Moyer, who does, they both do oral histories, in particular with communities of color. And the conversation there and the ethics around, like, not only, you know, how you originate it, but knowing where it's going to go and what the lifespan of it will be is really important. And no, I never force students to publish anything. Or if I do, they know right from the beginning that we're going to broadcast this on the radio, and so that they can make their decisions accordingly. But even then, like, if something came up, I would, you know, I would never ask them to publish something they didn't feel like they wanted to do, or that it was that they weren't, you know, happy with the final product. Or, and I'd also make sure that they always, before we did anything like that, that they would play it for everyone who's in it and like circulate it, and so they have the people that are creating it with them also have stake in that and some kind of agency over how their voice is part of this. Also, like, whenever we're doing anything in the community, I often try to like have paid community consultants like that can hear and be a sounding board, especially if you have students that are not from the surrounding community. Like Binghamton, unfortunately, only has 6% of our students are from Broome County. So whenever students go out into the community, by and large, many of them are not from the community. So I do two things. One, I always do like a resource kind of questionnaire. So I find out who in the class is from the area, and I often try to disperse. They become experts, which is one of the most powerful things about this, is then I disperse one of them in each group so they can, you know, they can all give their feedback, and then I try to have a consultant, whether I pay them out of pocket or whether I get a grant or have my department, and please like have them compensated, and so they can also be another like third party listener and give them feedback, so it's not just the students in an echo chamber telling stories. But yeah, just open communication, conversation, and definitely having clarity in writing that everyone has a hold of.
Yeah, I haven't taught radio in a classroom setting exactly, but I think like the consultant thing is like really amazing, and I haven't heard like a professor's doing that before, so I just want to like say that.
You.
It's like really awesome. Yeah, I took a class with Adrienne Keene called New Media as a Tool for Social Change, and for that class, our final was like a radio story, and it was kind of dealing with these themes of like community engagement and how to like ethically engage with like the surrounding community. And Yeah, just echoing what you said, I think just like full transparency on like all ends from the very beginning is like a really good practice. Like talking like with like the people that you are like interviewing, like your co-creators, like about like what it would mean to have like that story published. And also just like constantly like checking in with like students about like if they're okay with like having their work published and if like that changes, like allowing that flexibility.
Yeah, they
I think
can take it down.
Right. Or, like again, yeah. Like I think I mean now here this is kind of the epitome of like a like archive of just like some stories that are more cringeworthy than others. Like just for me personally, just like looking at my old stories and like now hear this, it's like, oh God. But I think like these like digital spaces, like having a blog, like they're not permanent. Like, you know, like things can be deleted, things can be like changed. So I think things can be re-uploaded even. So I think just like allowing that like flexibility at all stages is like something that I've seen like in the classroom, and I think it's a good like practice.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that there are a lot of different like ways to share our work. Could be that there's like a Google Drive that's just shared with other class members, like with all of the pieces in it. It could be like that you like get together and the final class is just like listening to everybody's podcast, and so it's like a one-time sharing thing. Or it could be like a more public, these like different degrees of more public like publication. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or it could be a one-time radio broadcast. Yeah. There's like many options.
And I would say add that like their center on campus, the Civic Engagement Center, is also a good place to talk to about these kinds of best practices and who they are already working with in the community, and like being in touch with what else is happening. It can be really good too, because they can point you to people that can help with that, build those relationships, or that they have longstanding relationships with.
That's a good point, given the transitory nature of like a lot of student life, like coming in and out, so having more established relationships. Okay, one more question. What are you listening to right now, podcast-wise, or audio story-wise? It's okay if you don't have an answer, but that was a question from the audience. I'm bringing them in space.
I am still, my favorite show right now is On Break, like on a indefinite break, which is really heartbreaking. It's like just like not, I don't know when it's being produced again. It's called like The Heart. I'm just like constantly going back and re-listening to The Heart and just like waiting for the day that it comes back. I'd say that.
I haven't been listening to much radio lately. If I'm being completely honest. Yeah, I've been listening to a lot of like one-off pieces. I'm really, really into the work of the poet Phil Smith right now. Generally, yeah, I think he's amazing.
I've been listening to Still Processing. I really love Still Processing. And the New York Times, Wesley Morris and
Jenna Wortham.
Yeah, they are amazing. I think that Code Switch just keeps getting better and better. It already was amazing, but the range of the stories that they're telling, and they really always push the envelope for how they're telling the story, and they're very conscious of framing and of course Sounding Out, because it's very always something different. We just published a podcast from Australia called Ring Out Fairly, that it's about a colleague there documenting women's prison abolition activism in Australia in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's a really cool, I loved how she put together archival footage with contemporary interviews, and also the way that they represented the news and like really kind of like use the media not as like here's what happened, but the way that she juxtaposed the women reflecting on it with what the coverage was at the time. And they actually like physically made a ring around the prison, Fairly Prison, and they performed music. They you know, banged on the walls, and the women inside were yelling and banging back. And it's a really powerful story.
What's the name of that again?
Ring Out Fairly, WRING Out Fairly, FARILE. A colleague at the Melbourne Law School is doing research on it. And so one thing I love to do in my job is travel and meet folks at podcasts and ask them to share with Sounding Out. And one of the things we like to do also is that podcast was just produced as a one-off on SoundCloud. And she's like, oh, you know, we love the story. We want, you know, the women to get more recognition, but I just kind of published it myself on SoundCloud. It's got like 9 views. And so I'm like, well, I can help with that. Like, part of what we do is share our audience and bring podcasts, you know, publishing it through us helps it get circulation and get those stories out. Because the distribution networks are really important to talk about too, especially as podcasts proliferate. How do we get our stories out to people rather than just kind of having them there waiting? And something like Sounding Out, like, you know, our real intervention is building the network that we can then pass on and share things to.
Yeah, and I think me and Alex maybe have not been listening to too much radio because we listen to a lot of Now Hear This because as managing editors. So y'all should check out Now Hear This. We just came out with a new like issue or like audio magazine a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I was going to say I've mostly been listening to my students' work, literally, which is not publicly available, but is really good.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you guys so much again. And I want to thank you all for being here and being an engaging audience.